ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Speaking Out.
We're mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration,
and energy. I'd just like to talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition.
With Larissa Berendt.
It's a fresh view coming
on ABC Radio.
In terms of the space of anti-racism, I think it is in the expected space, as the best theorising about race comes from the struggle and the fine. I mean, my best understanding of power came from laying on a concrete floor in a watch house. You know, I had to understand it. And I haven't read any academic article that could describe what that was and what you do in that moment and how you exercise your agency in that moment. And so I just think that my beef is with, you know, our race scholars in this country who, you know, have chastised me for not being a proper scholar. The theorists are those that are on the front line of struggle.
In the world of academia, we often see racist ideologies and stereotypes being used as fact. So how does a First Nations academic come into this world and keep their fierce indigeneity at the centre of their work? Dr. Chelsea Watego does just that as an academic writer and black thinker. This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt. Chelsea Watego is a proud Mananjali and South Sea Islander woman who grew up in the south of Brisbane. As a self-proclaimed nerd, she has used writing as a way of expressing her feelings of rage, anger, and frustration. Attending the University of Queensland, she quickly realised that the studies being done about Indigenous peoples either abandon a black perspective or would reaffirm dangerous stereotypes about our communities. For 20 years, she has worked as a researcher and health worker in the Indigenous health sector, leading her to be a professor of Indigenous health at QUT's School of Public Health and Social Work. She's also used her passion for writing to call out racism within national institutions and organisations. Her new book, Black Thoughts Matter, Essays on Black Love, Black Power and Black Joy, centres Indigenous humanity, giving us a wide lens look at the reality of the black human experience. I recently had the honour of sitting down with Chelsea at the Surry Hills Neighbourhood Centre in Sydney at an event hosted by the Racial Justice Centre. Let's take a listen now to our conversation.
It's so joyous to be here to celebrate this tome. I love it, 400 and plus pages, and it looks like a little Bible according to Chelsea Watego. I love it, and we'll dive into it. Congratulations, first of all. It's quite an achievement and reflects over a decade of really rigorous intellectual work.
Thank you.
So it's, I'm going to, if the words don't work, I think I can throw it as a bit of a...
Well, I do think it can double as a weapon. Yeah. I mean, words are weapons, but also the book itself. But thanks for acknowledging as intellectual work. I think part of the introduction to this is this holds the work that I was chastised for writing as an academic, you know, the online and editorials, op-eds type of thing, and literally houses a decade. And yeah, I was, it's a lot of the thinking on the run. So it is a bit of a confessional about what I learned through the process of thinking out loud with people in the course of that.
I guess one of the things too, that apart from how stocky it is, that struck me when I read it was the breadth of which you've published around as well. And we'll dig into some of that, but it is expansive.
So I guess I get angry about a lot of things.
Well, don't stop. We're all about encouraging you. But I guess it was, might start with asking you, what made you want to put this book together now? I mean, books always have their own way of finding their own time. So what was it about this book and how did you go about collating and curating what you'd done so eclectically over such a period of time?
Yeah, look, I think I have Dr. David Singh to blame for the idea of the book. He had suggested that I compile all of this work because it's sitting on lots of different platforms that don't exist anymore as well. And he said it's really hard to find all of your work and you need a place to hold it all. And I didn't want to just republish old work, but I wanted to, it was interesting looking at how to organise it, and I decided to organise it chronologically and thematically and try and go, oh, hang on, I wasn't just angry. There were patterns in what I wrote and the shift also in when I first thought about race and gender to what the how the work was put to work. And but I also got to look at like the clothes I wore when I was a teenager almost. You know, you look back at your old writing and you go, oh, why did I do that? And so I thought I wanted to reflect on that, actually write about the writing process, what I learned, because I wanted this one to be a kind of a manual for other writers. And over the years of supervising PhD students or working with other writers, particularly black writers who, you know, the look in the eye of black fellas who believe that they're intellectually inferior and how you've got to speak to them to get them to stand in their story. And I've said that, I've had so many of those conversations. I'm like, I'm going to put in a book to say all the things to that the black writer needs to hear in finding the way to tell their own stories. So it is a bit of a, look, these are the mistakes I made, the learnings that I gained, and this is all the advice you need to ignore in order to be known as a good writer. Be a black writer and write for a black audience and not silence yourself or reduce your theorising to whatever's deemed palatable to a white audience, because I mean you would know, and I think most academics know the review process, and particularly it's white woman editors. It doesn't matter what the platform or what the medium, who would always get the black thinker to centre the black, the white reader, the black thinker to centre the black reader, the white reader. I can't even speak, but it was always this urge back. And you know, a lot of writers have to make concessions because that draft isn't always the best and you have to change some things. But it was to get black writers to think about what you're going to fight for, what you're going to fight to keep in the, in your work.
I find that really reassuring because I think the older I get, the more I realise the less I knew when I spoke so confidently as a young person. So I like to think that's sort of the process of getting older and wiser. But it's true. I think one of the striking things is that you look at a section of the book and you have been consistent in your advocacy or reflection in that area, and you can see how it travels over time. So I'd like to dig a little bit more into that and also into where you position yourselves in self in relation to your writing as well. But just before we dive into the book itself, I also wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you landed on the title. What I like about it is Black Thoughts Matter. You position us as intellectuals and prioritize that. But you're riffing off Black Lives Matter and all of the politics and its positioning in colonisation. And then almost, I think, for me in typical Chelsea style, your subtitle is Essays on Black Love, Black Power and Black Joy, which are all strengths-based and are ideas that are very confronting, particularly to a non-Indigenous audience, particularly Black Love, Black Joy, that they don't tend to be very comfortable with Black Power either. And I just wonder if you could, to me, in many ways, that captures a lot about how you approach your writing about difficult issues, but you come from a strengths-based approach. I wonder if you could talk about how you brought those concepts together.
Yeah. I mean, the focus on thoughts was also about speaking to the anti-intellectualism that sometimes we have, and not that I'm, you know, I didn't come from a family where you go to university and all that kind of stuff, and I don't believe universities are the things that will save us. Often the opposite. You know, I've always argued that there is a role for the nerds on the front line. And, you know, there's important theorising as black fellas that have always informed our struggles. And that we have, you know, I feel very grateful for the privilege to have a job where I get to think, read and write. I don't take that for granted. For as much as I might criticise the academy, it is such a special thing to be able to go to work to do that. And but yeah, it was, I guess, to make a case for the philosophies that underpin so many of our struggles, and the love, power and joy. I had to find a way to kind of what best summarizes how what holds these texts, and those were the things. And I don't know that I was consciously taking a strength-based approach. What I was wanting to do, and certainly the work that we're advancing, is really centering Indigenous humanity, because we know about our fights, our struggles, our trauma, But alongside of all of that, we do have love, joy and power. And it's not a one or the other. We are all of those things. And this is what it means to be fully human, is to have the full range of experience. Yeah.
I think you look back at people like Gary Foley or Sam Watson, and they're hugely intellectual giants, but referred to as firebrands or activists in that way of diminishing the deep intellectual underpinnings of our rights movement. I feel like the way that you position your work really acknowledges that, acknowledges the intellectual tradition while sort of mocking the audacity of people who want to diminish it in that way. I think one of the things I love about your writing is I find new ways to express ideas. So let's talk a little bit about how you very powerfully shifted from the idea of reclamation to refusal, because I think that's a very powerful way of positioning yourself.
Yeah, from reclamation to refusal, it shows in the writing. You read the themes in each, no matter what the topic is, there is this. Because I think one of my earliest op-eds that I was asked to write was one on Australia Day, and that was going back like a long time ago, but it was one of the most read ones in the conversation, and it was celebrated. And I hate reading it now. I hate that it exists, because it was written to educate a broader audience about why I might feel uncomfortable with Australia Day, you know. And it was at a time where it would have been in Magandjan, there was a handful of people at Musgrave Park at Jaguar Hall would raise the flag. Now we see tens of thousands of people walk across that bridge and we see it across the country. So it was of a different time. I do recognise that, and just shows in such a short time how we can, the shifts that are possible in our consciousness around these things. But, yeah, I think in a lot of these the common thread with each chapter, and you see with that early writing, is the, you know, being a good academic and explaining things, educating people. And it shifts to this is what it is. But also writing to a black audience and not to a general audience and going, no. And I think Indigenous X as a platform, I have to acknowledge that was writing for Indigenous X versus the conversation, very different process. You know, the joy of being able to put like GIFs and memes in essays, and they're unfortunately not in the book and being reproduced, but I got to play with style. Whereas the conversation, I mean, even as recently as 2 months ago, I pitched an article and they came back and said, we actually want it to be this. Here's the title, paragraph one should say this, paragraph two should say that. So, yeah, shout out to the conversation and the health editor. But imagine telling like a black professor of health how to structure an article on health based on research that we're undertaking on a nationally funded research project.
I was just, yes, it is 2025.
And so the different platforms also enabled me to express myself differently. And sometimes in early career writing, you know, writers can focus on the prestige of the publication. And I remember my PhD supervisor, Professor Mark Brough, saying to me, don't worry about where your work gets published. If it's good writing, it will be read, it'll be cited. And I returned to that in the course of this, of going, well, you know, the conversation may have prestige and it has the fancy dashboard where you can track your metrics and all the kind of stuff, but what you have to concede in order to get those words out there is not worth getting published. And so having these different platforms to play in enabled me to be able to take a different stance and not have that white editor pulling the strings on you know, the theoretical work that we're doing.
It's such an important point about where your work sits when you are a serious, well-respected academic.
And I wouldn't know what that feels like.
Well, you are by the people who matter, like me. But I guess, yeah. I see myself in the same way. When you talk about the difference between Indigenous X and the conversation, amplify that with the difference between an Indigenous X and you know, a law journal, where you're peer-reviewed by non-Indigenous people who think that you should not be an advocate for anything, let alone they would call you an activist, as they do me. So I haven't actually published in one for decades. I can say that now because I'm ye olde now. But I thought when I was starting out, that's what I had to do. And it's been quite liberating to not do that and to let it go. And so I find great strength in seeing the way you've crafted a career. So
well,
I just want to
let you followed yours a little bit.
but I wonder if you could share. I think this is such an important message for anyone who's in that academic space or that research space or even that writing space, that lesson about it's not about fitting with the conformity of what the academy or the profession says you should do, but it's finding the thing you believe in and finding your voice and following that. Because I see that's what I've seen you do. That's what's in this book.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that helped me in terms of finding my voice and a lot of this writing was shaped from was back when we had Twitter and when Blackfella Twitter was a thing, because often the thinking would come from the Blackfella Twitter. Oh, hello, Professor Sullivan. Sorry, just saw you. And so that was a moment. And so a lot of Blackfella Twitter had created this space where no matter what the public discourse was, this was the story. And so it created this whole other space in which we could say, no, this is actually the conversation we want to have and that we're having anyway. And so I miss the day of that kind of platform that we used to have where we were playing with ideas. There was no sense of, well, you can be a Noel because you have an academic title. Mob of participating Blackfella Twitter and the joy, the theorising, I mean, the humour of Blackfella Twitter, I miss that platform because we were clever and funny and, you know, Blackfella Twitter, when that moved on a particular issue, man, they were the good old days. TikTok's not the same. I can't stand it.
Damn that Elon Musk. You've written also, I mean, I think one of the things that's also really important to acknowledge in the sort of work that you do is that it's hard, right? You haven't chosen the easy path. You're not a black face in a white academy. You've chosen a path that's transformative and it's hard. And I think the thing about anyone who's in the room who is affecting change will find that there is pushback on that. And it is, you can be in a really hard place. One of the things I think you talk really reflectively about is the idea of exhaustion. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you do navigate and how you've learned over time to navigate the cost of, the personal price of speaking out about the things that you speak out about. So, well, unfiltered. You don't filter yourself to, in a way, be
polite. I'm not sure I'm a good person to reflect on that. Maybe cautionary tale. Look, I think 2025 was when I really got a full appreciation of what it means to experience the violence of speaking truth to power. I mean, I've had my doses of it, you know, behind closed doors institutionally. That's not, you know, publicly available, but and in, you know, various different disciplines and different journal editors, that kind of thing. But certainly I think this year was probably the most trying. And I had to think about, because for me writing and a lot of this work, the writing was, I was writing trying to make sense of something, making sense of an injustice or something that just didn't sit right. It was often to correct the public discourse or so I often wrote out of frustration and often was exhausted in the process of it because this was the after hours work. It wasn't what I could do in the day job. And so I could counter my mind to make sense of things, make sense of the feelings. And so, you know, some of these pieces, I was writing for myself, not for an audience. I was trying to make sense of this thing that happened. The Black Men in Suits article, which every black woman thought they knew that black man in the suit. But that was an encounter I'd had, and I just had to make sense of the injustice of what had happened, and I ended up, you know, creating something out of it. And so it was therapeutic. So for me, writing had been therapeutic, but there is a challenge with the downside of, you know, black thoughts is being able to let the mind rest. And I'm still, like, working on the balance of that because it also gets excited to make sense of things. And I like that my mind could be of service when people are broken and don't have the capacity to make sense of it. Then I'm like, the nerd to the rescue, I can make sense of it. And it's a lot of the work we do with, you know, people navigating race discrimination processes who can't read their employer's 20-page investigation about them. And I'm like, give it to me. I'll do it. You don't have to. And I'll find the words. So I love that I've got the power to do that. But it comes with its challenges of then going, okay, well, maybe you need to turn the thinking off. And like I tried the magnesium soaks and stuff, but that mind keeps going. So I'm a work in progress in terms of turning the mind off because, you know, I get hyper-focused and it's like I got to get this out of my body. And it was funny, like after I wrote Another Day in the Colony, I wrote it when I was broken. I was on sick leave in the midst of these two race discrimination cases. My body refused to function. And so I thought, well, I'll write the book. I'll make sense of it. And so it was in that exhaustion that I wrote. It wasn't because I was in this great place and now I can write. I write from the place of anger, of sadness, of exhaustion, and finding the words does something for me and for others to be able to name it and externalize it, that it's not about us. This is the machinery. This is how it's working and let's not carry that. So it's this weird thing of the mind's racing, but at the same time it's like, oh, because I've got to get the violence that I'm potentially taking on board and I've got to get the words to externalize it so it's not sitting in here, that it doesn't find a place in my consciousness and what I believe about myself. So it's kind of, I don't know, it's like a double-edged sword in some respects, I think.
Yeah, I guess I was interested in it because obviously observing the terrible attacks on your work this year from people who are obviously threatened by it, your response to that is this, like, you're certainly not going to be silenced. And I love that element of resistance. But
people don't realise that when you come for me, you become the story. Like, I don't know how to shut the mouth.
Well, then they're still not good. I don't know that they're fast learners either, Chelsea, I'm just saying. But, and I guess the other thing that strikes me too, which is why I was wondering about this thing about how you handle that difficult space to be in, is one of the things I love about your writing and just about the way you approach the world is, of course, you always embrace that Blackfella humour.
Yeah.
And that feels like it is a part of that therapy and your ability to find the absurd or the ironic in what you're dealing with is a really great way. I'm not sure I can't speak for you, so I'm interested to know how much that allows you to process it. But it certainly allows us as your readers, as fellow Blackfellas, to process as well.
Yeah, and I guess it's part of that. This is what that looks like when you don't accept the logics that they're trying to inscribe upon your body and you can see if it is and you go, that's a joke. Like, it's not ours to carry. So why should I feel broken or hurt by something that actually isn't about me? And so I love being able to shift the gaze from the black body and all its supposed incapabilities to show the violence of these structures and systems and tell the truth about them. And, I mean, settler colonialism itself is absurd. The idea of terra nullius is absurd. It's hilarious that you could come to a place and think it was unoccupied with so many black people across the continent. You know, like, it's ridiculous. And so it's actually when you sit with the truth of it, you can see it's a joke. And I'd much rather make them the punchline than be the punching bag. And so through the writing, it reconfigures that relationship. But also it's like, it's the truth of who we are. Like, you know, we've got the funniest funeral stories. Like, we laugh at the most ridiculous things and, yeah, maybe humour is for healing, but it's also being human. Mm. And, you know, settlers love and have this really enormous appetite for sad blackfellas. Like, every movie, every book, every documentary, they love it. And that's what we got in trouble for this year, is we decided to have a great race debate and laugh at racists. And that became, and I noted at the time, I did say, we walked out of the theatre and I said, everyone was on a high and laughing and I said, enjoy it because we've only got a few minutes of this and they're going to come for us on that. And sure enough, they did, and suddenly satire's not a thing and punch him in the throat is a real call to violence. Like, you know, it was just ridiculous. But the anger at our joy. And I still remember when we did Wild Black Woman, our first complaint we got was that we were laughing because we would, you know, take the piss out of the news every week. And I remember Angelina was like, well, okay, let's read the complaint out on air and let's play violins in the background. And we didn't finish the complaint because we all just like couldn't stop laughing. So yeah, I love Black Joy.
You did not learn your lesson at all, did you? And that's why I started with that. These ideas of black love, black power, black joy, they are revolutionary acts, they're subversive acts,
And it's not as a decoy away from fighting racism. So it's not like, oh, we won't take up the fight and let's
There's
just
a lot of
feel
that
good.
In here. I'm just saying, it's not an either or.
It's like it's central to any struggle. You must have all of these things. And of course we have all these things, like people who fight structural oppression, that is an act of love because you are hated for that. And I think that's what I've had to grapple with more than exhaustion is the hate that comes even from your own people and that resentment of how dare she, who does she think she is? And so I've had to process the logic of love in this work and that being hated is part of it. And that being hated doesn't mean that you're hateful. And if you know who you are and the grounds in which you're operating, it can help sort of keep that stuff at bay. But I've had to really think through hate this year.
Mm-hmm. Well, the two things I'll say that my aunties tell me, one is you can tell a lot about a person by who their enemies are.
Hmm.
So you can, and I've just forgotten what the other thing is that they told me. When I remember it, I'll come back to it. Sorry.
That was academic and writer Dr. Chelsea Watego talking with me about her book, Black Thoughts Matter, Essays on Black Love, Black Power and Black Joy.
Stuck here, I'm being so clear. I gotta go someday. Ooh. Someday. It's not too much, it's not too much to wanna be loved the way I love. It's not too much. It's not too much to want not love the way I love. It's not too much, it's not too much to want not be loved the way I love. Oh, 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 and petals, my darling, please don't ever settle. The sun will shine another day. Get the fuck out of the way. I don't have nothing to prove. Got to do what I got to. You're stuck here, I'm being so clear. I got to go. So
That was Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander artist Kian with The Way I Love. This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt. On this episode, we've been listening to my conversation with academic writer and black thinker, Dr. Chelsea Watego. We've been discussing her latest book, Black Thoughts Matter, essays on black love, black power and black joy. It is compiled of her essays and posts from social media, giving us a full look at the experience of Indigenous academics and writers.
One of the things you do really nicely in your the volume of your work, actually, is there are clear thinkers that you really admire and you pay homage to. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about, particularly the women thinkers that you have really shaped your thinking. And you also honour the intellectual labour of aunties, mothers, friends of women. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about that.
I don't want to name because then I will forget who I didn't name.
Well, I just forgot something as well. Yeah. So feel free to forget things.
Lots of people I've learned from and with and through, and as someone whose work has been taken and not cited, I know the violence of the ways in which our work, the extractive nature of that work, that you can be hated but people take your thinking and repackage it, and it's far too frequent. For me, it's always about citing those, you know, who has shaped my thinking. And sometimes it's Barker's song lyrics. It's not always, you know, the learned academic. It's an encounter that I might have with someone. And so our black theorists are everywhere, not just in universities. And so for me, it's important to cite how others have shaped my thinking, because none of us come to know things purely because we're clever. We are all products of other people's knowledge and experience, and I try to be really conscious about how I properly acknowledge how my thinking's been shaped by someone else's thinking, how their work has created the space for me to even exist like this. I think about I need Dr. Lilla Watson a lot, and we did a yarn not long ago on for Read the Play, and it was really interesting because she talks about knowledge not as something that one person can possess, and even she's very has this humility about not claiming even her own quotes, because she's like, it's not mine. That was shaped by someone else. And so it has, I mean, I'm very much cite black woman, but there is this thing about knowledge as relational, and sometimes those rules within the academy don't always sit well with our knowledge systems and how they operate. So I'm kind of a bit...
Well, that's why I guess that was sort of at the heart of my question was the way in which you actually do look beyond the academy to where knowledge really sits, that kind of idea that you don't earn it through a PhD or publications or whatever, but actually it is in places that are unexpected, that wisdom is in many ways a lot more democratic.
Well, and I think it's also in terms of the space of anti-racism, I think it is in the expected spaces. The best theorising about race comes from the struggle and the fight. I mean, my best understanding of power came from laying on a concrete floor in a watch house. You know, I had to understand it. And I haven't read any academic article that could describe what that was and what you do in that moment and how you exercise your agency in that moment. And so I just think that my beef is with, you know, our race scholars in this country who, you know, have chastised me for not being a proper scholar. The theorists are those that are on the front line of struggle. And, you know, when I first started coming to race, understanding it as a structure, because the health sciences didn't want us to do that, but we're supposed to talk about our culture to fix our health, I was going to the works of Vernon Arkey and Richard Bell, because there wasn't a language 15 years ago about race in the health system. Like, that's a relatively new thing. And to think about race and whiteness, it's, of course, Richard Bell. So it was the artist that I was understanding how to give voice to, even, you know, thinking about race as a structure, because my discipline had made very clear that we don't do that kind of work. And we pretend that race hasn't built biomed sciences and all of that. So I've always, that's always where I've learnt from. And I think about my own father, he was a truck driver, but was a race scholar, better than some of the race scholars here that have the citations. Because he had to navigate, he had to theorise about it, and he had to put it to the test. It's one thing to cite theory, and but it's another thing to actually fight racism, like deal with power. And the theorising that comes in the midst of throwing those punches is something else, and our people are doing it all the time on so many front lines. And yeah, and academics have not caught up with that or have divorced themselves from that struggle. And I just think, because it's in our community, you can't do that. You can't write about something and not have a relationship to it. You get called out. You get dragged. Even if you do, you get dragged. But, you know, you get called out for that stuff. So in our communities, we're required to do that. But white fellas, they can become professors in these things and be completely removed from it. Because their relationship to knowledge production, you know, it has colonizing urge to know, to acquire, to take. And we can't do that. We get in trouble.
That's right. I mean, I often think one of the greatest cultural conflicts we have to navigate is that idea that the white academy or white culture has, European culture has, that knowledge is something anyone can take.
Mm.
And it's so different to us where we have no... We don't question the idea that there's men's business and women's business. We don't think that that we're excluded. We accept that that's a stronger way and that we're respected with our knowledge of women's business. And
yes, same, that non-possessive way of being.
Yeah.
And even because, you know, the idea of objectivity and impartiality, black fellas know that doesn't exist.
That's right.
We know it doesn't exist, and we know that multiple truths can coexist because we have mobs that have lived side by side and know that are different but coexist. And there's no need to take over that one and impose your way because, you know, they're mob different kind. That's how they go. And that's okay.
Mm.
And this idea of coexistence, colonisers don't know coexistence.
They don't know coexistence. They don't know interconnectedness. And I don't think they realise that the idea of objectivity is a bigger lie as terra nullius.
Absolutely.
I remembered the second thing. No one can take away your talent.
Oh,
that was the second thing. So that's the true. Other thing. Doesn't matter what they say about you, they can't take away your talent. I remembered that. I love also too what you say about the knowledge that we get from our great intellectual thinkers who are our artists, and that there is actually, it's a part of the way our culture works with creative practice being a form of knowledge. And I agree with you. I think you can look at our art and it doesn't matter where it comes from, the level of intellectual an understanding of the world that's whether it's something that's from Western Desert or it's from our Southeastern artists who don't mince their words, there is a level of intellectual thought that far outperforms what you get from book learning. And I love that you bring that kind of thing into the forefront. One of the areas that you dive, I'm going to dive into a couple of places in the book.
Okay, go on then.
I mean, I was probably not surprisingly, I'm always interested in your commentary around the myriad of issues that arise around racism in sport. It's the perfect microcosm of society. And you've looked at it in several different ways with a collection of works that are in here. So I wonder if you could talk about how you see sport revealing the nation's deeper racial logics.
Yeah, look, so there is a chapter, I think, I can't remember what it's called, the chapter, okay. Where I organised...
But I love the audacity of Lumumba, sorry.
Yes. And this is where I got to think a lot about race through these sporting moments. So I sort of organised all of the articles I'd written about sporting field. Turns out there's a lot of AFL in there and a bit of rugby league. And so I had to reflect on this body of work. And what was interesting, it started off with, I think I was like reviewing the Goods documentary, you know, just I was a spectator on the sidelines of these sporting fields and these stages in which race was playing out. You know, the acts of resistance from the black athletes to the blowback they suffered and how, you know, Australians lost their shit the moment it was named and, you know, to the final piece was writing the statement of who's known publicly in the media as Amy around the Hawthorne case, which was a really tragic, tragic what she went through. And we were working with her in the immediate aftermath of that report when she chose to refuse to participate in the independent investigation that they had launched. And so we worked with her with that statement. So I went from being a spectator to being alongside in the fight, which was interesting to discover in organising this work. But I'd always loved, I mean, I have a love-hate relationship. We love looking at racism on sporting fields, but we don't like to, you know, there's not as many documentaries about racism everywhere else. You know, I want to see some docos on missing and murdered Aboriginal women. I want us to think about how race is playing out all the time and everywhere, not just the sporting field, because gender's playing out here as well in terms of who we celebrate as the worthy victims and warriors in the fight against racism. You know, and netball players, there hasn't been enough analysis on the black netball players who've had to deal with racism in the same way it has in men's sport. So I just that disclaimer. However, so much to learn around that. And in writing about race and sporting field was that I wanted to correct the account of particularly the black man who had spoken out about racism in all of these. And, you know, from Tamana Tahu and the way in which he was cast and the punishment that he would suffer as a result of standing in defence of black fellows who were on the opposing side. And, you know, I'm proud Queenslander when it comes origin time, not any other time, so-called Queensland, but to see someone on the other side of the border stand with our fellas was something else, because origin time, them lines are drawn, Murrays and Currys, that's just it. But to see that, you know, that moment, and there wasn't enough attention brought to that. The way in which Goods was cast as, you know, couldn't hack it. No, his stance was one of power. And, you know, to tell him to get ripped for the victory lap at the end of the year, that was power. And so I wanted to re-narrate how they'd been cast, because black men, when they speak about racism, you know, get emasculated. They're not, you know, and I'm like, no, we should be proud of our men standing up. And when a black man expresses publicly any vulnerability about being hurt, then it comes even harder on them. But any other day of the week, they're cast as perpetrators, as abusing women and children. Yet the moment there's any bit of vulnerability, they're weak. And so, you know, I have written some piece about black men in tailored suits, but I have defended black men in the fight because it really made me wild that I just wanted to go, no, hang on, pay attention over here. This is what we can actually learn from this. This is what we can see about the power of black resistance wherever that takes place.
Yeah, it is that. It's another place where we see that theme, where it's the idea of assertion rather than assimilation, but it is also that exploration of how much self-determination there is in the word no, in the refusal to be a part of the final lap or whatever it is.
And it was, I mean, looking at these moments, because there's all the takes on race and sport, but it was able to then, you know, draw on Mohawk scholar Audra Simpson's refusal as an exercising of sovereignty and go, well, here's some of the theory and how to make sense of these things. And so because the analysis on these things reproduces the very violent racialized logics in it. And so, you know, trying to interfere with that. And what we see when people make race complaints or break the silence, the violence of the racism gets reproduced in every process that follows. And it's even more so. And so sometimes people go to the public square to get it addressed, or they'll go to HR or to the Human Rights Commission, and there is this sense that something will happen. And what happens is the very violence that you're wanting to get respite from is going to be further compounded over and over again through every step. And so I wanted to interfere on that and go, no, hang on, remember this and let that hold you in the midst of this fight. Because everyone watches this stuff, right? And people go to work and make a decision whether they're going to speak up or not. And they'll see what's happened. I think about what happened to Ezra Mam last year, how he started the season, how he ended the season, that was directly connected. And people will see that and go, oh, well, the lesson is don't speak up, keep quiet. And I don't want black fellas to watch this violence and say, okay, be quiet. That's not what we need the next generation to be doing.
It's a tricky space that you wade into there because there is such a, it's such a big part of the dominant culture. And in a way, the Aboriginal heroes that you've identified who've stood up are really a minority and pay a really big price for it. What do you think, what are your thoughts on, in with that kind of dynamic, the sorts of tools we've got to keep fighting? And I guess a very important question for this audience, in those sorts of situations, what is the responsibility of people who claim to be allies?
Oh, jeez, not the allies.
Had to come in somewhere. It was going to be rallying call or allies.
Well, I won't get to the allies just yet. Look, I'm sure the allies are going to be fine, whatever I say anyway.
Okay.
In terms of like fighting racism and this idea that, you know, the hero and what comes at you, the thing about fighting racism and, you know, attending to race as a structure of power, you do have to develop understanding of different types of power. And sometimes in the midst of the fight, we can see so more visible institutional power. Because it comes full force the moment you open that mouth, it comes at you. And it can be overwhelming and it's meant to be violent. And I guess that's what I'm trying to do with all of the writing that I do is we have a power and it's because of that power is why it's visited upon us. And I had to make sense of this of going, oh, the greater the force that comes against me is because it's my power. And sometimes we forget that in the fight. Why is this happening to me? I should have done this. And we beat ourselves up because we accept that. And power is not something that colonizers possess exclusively. Blackfellas have power individually and collectively. We know that. And oftentimes in the midst of the fight, that's where you also get greater clarity about that power. We think we might have power when we're safe and they bestow us these opportunities or these things and that's, the you know, climb the hierarchy and therefore we have power. No, 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 there's greater power and freedom often in the fight. Because when you get to the point where we have to do things and you discover your capabilities in those moments, and so it's not all doom and gloom. Yeah, it's hard. But I think about times where I've been welcomed in versus when I've been kept at the margins, and I'm far more creative and far more innovative when I'm at the margins than when I'm welcomed in. And the closer I get to institutional power, the less power I have as a person. It's just, I mean, I had to go off Twitter because I wasn't meeting with the registrar weekly about people complaining about my Twitter. I mean, okay, fine, have it. And so institutional power, this idea of institutional power, it doesn't hold the promise that we think it has. And sometimes it's about just letting go of that kind of power. Because that's always going to be there. You're not going to change that. That's going to be there. But who are you going to be?
It's really interesting. We came into this question through the area of sport, but the other area I was going to ask you about was the media. And in a way, it's the same dynamic, isn't it? That you think you don't have power, but the closer you get, maybe I should give up my job at the ABC. I'm maybe getting too close to it.
Well, no, but the, like it's the, you know, the young cadets and the journalists who want to go mainstream as well and think that mainstream is the side of power. And you look at the work of Dr. Amy Maguire, who's went, has always worked independent black media, and the quality of her work is far better than anyone that's gone through the ranks of, you know, mainstream media. And what can be created when you let go of their power and you build your own things on your own terms, there's so much that can be done. And so oftentimes we are doing things to get approval, to get acceptance, to get permission. And it's not worth it. So you might as well build it anyway and just do it. I mean, Anala Wongra that's existed for 20 years with no operational funding. We're not a set service. We do all kinds of things because we just do it. And that's what sovereignty is to me, is of the doing it anyway, that you doesn't require someone to gift it to you. And, yeah, it might be a little bit harder, but it's far more fun. And the idea of, for me, it's about thinking about what is freedom in a settler colonial state. And there's something about the freedom that's found at the margins that I think more people should be not complaining about being marginalised, but go, okay, what can we get away with? What can we do?
No one's watching at the margins.
It's, yeah. And at the margins, because it's like, and we have this debate between the reformers and the abolitionists and that kind of thing. And I hate the binary of it. But when you're at the margins, you are literally pushing the margins this way. And the reformers will say, well, we're doing this work and we're making the change with the trickle-down effect. And I'm like, no, the people at the margins are pushing it this way. And those at the margins are creating the space for reformers to exist, because if it wasn't, weren't calling it out, then they would not need to create positions for people to reform things to placate the movement. And so I don't think it's an either or, and that probably framed it in that way, but I think it's about recognising that there are various strategies in our fight and people have different roles to play, and the reformers need the radicals as well. And I think that's what's irritated me in the aftermath of the referendum and the healing that's yet to happen amongst our own mob, is this idea of yes and no. It's all of the things, and we should be all on the same side irrespective of which role we're cast in the course of this work. And how can we go, okay, well, this one's going to run this way, these mob going to be outside. And I remember a black politician saying, I love when uncle's outside protesting because it makes it easy for me to fight when I'm inside. And we've got to see how we're coordinating amongst ourselves.
I remember being at a conference once where the Indigenous advisor who they had to help them navigate these issues, and when there was a protest, ended up just joining the protest. And I thought, that's probably the only way you're going to get it done. Unfortunately, we're getting the wind up, but what a privilege to get to hear your thoughts, and we all can take them away with us in the Bible according to Chelsea Watergo.
Which it's not.
And I just want to thank people for turning up to listen to such, I think Chelsea's one of the most important voices that we have in the community, in the country, and I'm pleased so many people, it's the only time I'm going to say you're a sellout, Chelsea, but that so many people turned up to hear this wisdom. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with the unapologetic and fierce writer, academic and staunch black woman, Dr. Chelsea Watergo. She's a perfect example of what it means to own your narrative and be loud and proud doing it. That's the show for now. Join us again next time for more stories from across Indigenous Australia. Speaking Out is produced by Janaya Gibbs-Muir and Nadine Haynes. Our senior producer is Jay McAllister. And as always, you can find us on the ABC Listen app or on social media via ABC Indigenous, along with our Titter Show Away, hosted by Rudy Bremer. This week, Rudy takes you to the Western Desert to hear about the life and legacy of Clifford Possum. Having recently revisited his later years in the ABC and CBC co-production Forged, Rudy sets out to learn about the man beyond the headlines, the man his family knew and loved. I'm Larissa Berendt, and this is Speaking Out.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.